Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. This is our podcast going into the Labor Day weekend. Where are we in 2020? Well, we have some new jobs numbers out today showing the unemployment rate has now dropped below 10% for the first time since the pandemic began, 8.4%. That's good news. Expect that to be a Trumpian talking point. We also have more polls. I think the summary, without getting in too deep, is that Joe Biden continues to have a solid lead in the national polls, but you've heard this story before, the swing state polls are tight. So we'll talk about that in some future podcasts. But obviously, there's a lot of things that we need to talk about today, including, look, for some of you, this may not come as a huge surprise. In fact, in my newsletter this morning, I wrote about Jeffrey Goldberg's piece in The Atlantic about the suckers and losers, saying don't pretend you're actually surprised by this account, because the picture he paints is appalling, but it's recognizable because we've seen it so many times before, but still, it is shocking. It is just shocking that the commander-in-chief of this country thinks that the men and women who've lost their lives or been maimed defending their country are suckers and losers. According to the story, he doesn't want wounded veterans at his parades on the ground that spectators would feel uncomfortable in the presence of amputees. Nobody wants to see that, he said. We already know how he felt about POWs. This one story, though, is just, and, you know, by, you know, within a week or so, maybe we'll get more confirmation. I mean, there's some legitimate questions about sourcing, but still, these stories are so compelling. John Kelly, his former Secretary of Homeland Security and his chief of staff, his son, Robert, is buried in Section 60 at Arlington. He's a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps. Robert Kelly was killed in 2010 in Afghanistan when he was just 29 years old. And Trump was supposed to, on this visit, he was supposed to join John Kelly in paying respects at his son's grave and to comfort the families of other fallen service members. But according to these sources that are quoted in The Atlantic, and maybe one of them is going to be John Kelly at some point, Trump is standing by Robert Kelly's grave, turns to his father and says, "I don't get it. What was in it for them?" Now, Kelly didn't go on the record with Jeffrey Goldberg. And at first, he thought that maybe Trump was making some ham-handed reference to the selflessness of America's all-volunteer force. But later he came to realize that Trump simply does not understand non-transactional life choices. So again, as I'm recording this, we don't have any name sources in this story, but there are four sources. The story has been confirmed by the Associated Press and by the Washington Post. The Washington Post actually added an additional anecdote. They tell the story of Trump telling senior advisors that he didn't understand why the government placed such value on finding soldiers missing in action, because they had performed poorly and gotten caught and they deserved what they got, according to a person familiar with the discussion. Now, it is interesting watching the reaction right now. The anti-Trumpers, not surprisingly, they're not buying it. You know, they're skeptical. Where are these named sources? But see, here's the thing, and I hope people understand this. This is the agony of the anti-Trumpers. You know, even as they're professing skepticism and predicting retractions, deep down they know that this is most likely true. It's true because we've seen it so many times before. This is the lens through which Donald Trump views the world: losers versus winners, suckers versus killers. Now, does that extend to the military? Well, we know it does. We know what he said about John McCain and being a POW. We know that he's mocked the gold-starred families. We know in the past that he suggested that soldiers in Iraq were stealing money that they were supposed to be distributing. You know, remember back when he talked about Vietnam, he described, avoiding sexually transmitted diseases was his quote-unquote personal Vietnam, and said it made him feel like a great and very brave soldier. And look, Republicans have accepted all of this. And the anti-Trumpers found a way to look the other way. I mean, he told us who he was over and over again, and they just decided to ignore that. So I understand why people are being skeptical about this particular story, you know, without the named sources, although they may come forward at some point. But there's a particular reason why so many people on the right have chosen that they're not going to believe it. Because, and I want you to think about this, because if this really is who Donald Trump is, then they would have to really confront the choices they've made. And they've swallowed a lot. They have swallowed a great deal. They've looked the other way a lot. But if the commander in chief really is this small, vain, unempathetic, despicable man who dishonors everything he touches, well, that's a burden. That's an extra burden of things that they need to think about. And I want to make this distinction between the anti-Trumpers and the hardcore Trumpers, because the anti-Trumpers actually know who Donald Trump is. They just sort of choose not to act on it. I mean, but these are people, well, let's be honest about it. I mean, they think of themselves as decent people, caring, virtuous, and honorable Christians who believe in upholding American values, and they believe in American exceptionalism. They're very patriotic individuals. And again, this is what makes them different from the hardcore bootlickers, because they don't have any illusions about Trump's character. And they remember the times that he's mocked minorities, the disabled, and veterans. But they figure out ways to compensate in their consciences. Like, for example, today, they would much rather be talking about Nancy Pelosi's visit to a hair salon. So this story is very awkward, is super awkward for them, because it really raises the stakes, doesn't it? I mean, I wrote in my newsletter this morning, which I hope, if you haven't subscribed, I would certainly hope that you would. But what I wrote was that this story, if they believe it, would cause a stirring in the place where their consciences have been hibernating. So it's better to cling to doubt. It's better not to believe, even if they know it's true. There's another question that's sort of hanging out there, and Susan Glasser wrote about this as well. She said, okay, so where the hell were these sources when all of this happened? Did I miss the part where any of those who heard the president attack war heroes quit in protest or went on the record to tell us about it now? That's an excellent question. And I think the question now is, of course, will they speak now? Will they finally come out and say, hey, I think the public, 59 days until the election, needs to know what I saw, what I heard? So I think we're going to find out whether or not these sources in the military who have been so reluctant so far to come out, not all of them. I mean, we have had more and more coming forward. In fact, today's episode of the Bulwark podcast is going to feature one of those insiders who has made the decision to come forward. You may have seen this ad by the Republican Voters Against Trump, a powerful testimony from a woman named Elizabeth Newman.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Newman. I am first and foremost a follower of Jesus Christ. I voted for Trump in 2016 primarily because of the pro-life issue. I served in the Trump administration at the Department of Homeland Security and became the Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention. The reason government is supposed to exist is to prepare for external threats like we're seeing with COVID. There were plans put in place for a pandemic. When we started to see that a pandemic was on its way to our shores, experts told me we need to be executing on these plans. But from January until March 11th, what you saw instead was a number of good public servants attempting to do their job and the president telling them to stop because he didn't want the economy to tank and he didn't want a distraction from his campaign. I'm sorry, Mr. President, you were hired to handle America's worst day and you've absolutely failed. And this year I'll be voting for Joe Biden.
Defending Democracy Together is responsible for the content of this ad.
And joining us on today's Bulwark podcast is Elizabeth Newman. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you talked in that spot about the coronavirus, but I want to focus at least initially on something else you've talked about as well. One of your jobs was to counteract domestic extremism and domestic terrorism. And I want you to talk a little bit about that and what the problem is and why Donald Trump just simply doesn't want to talk about it. You know, I noticed that, you know, first of all, you went into office in early 2017, right? You joined the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes.
And so, again, what did you see in terms of domestic terrorism?
So I have to back up just a bit
sure.
and say that my career started in the Bush administration, and I was initially focused on domestic policies. And of course, 9/11 happened, and the agenda completely changed. And I ended up working in the Homeland Security Council in those first years it was stood up. And my entire career has been focused on this concept of counterterrorism within the homeland. So how do you equip our state and local law enforcement partners or emergency management officials to be able to counter whatever the threats of the day are? And for 15 plus years post 9/11, those threats were predominantly international terrorism, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others. And when we came in 2017, the assumption was that that was still the biggest threat. So the lens through which we were looking at the threat landscape was a default to that international terrorism. But we started to see things that made us kind of pause and question what is going on. It started in the 2016 campaign cycle, which at some level, we just brushed aside as campaign politics and rhetoric being really polarized. But you saw this language that was hateful and borderline, if not totally, about white nationalism, and you thought, you know, I think this is just a blip. You just kind of thought this was not necessarily going to stick around. But then we had a spate of vandalisms occur at Jewish cemeteries in March of 2017. That made us pause and ask what's going on. And then Charlottesville happened in August, and that really got everybody's attention. In Charlottesville, what we saw was this clothed in the rhetoric of conservatism, this idea of, the rally's name was Unite the Right. And so to the average person, initially, you're just like, okay, so you've got some polarized figures on the right clashing with some polarized figures on the left, Antifa, you know, being kind of prominent. And maybe that's all it is. And then when you saw the images, it just was very jarring. You had people, walking through the streets of Charlottesville clad in khaki pants and a button down shirt, saying Jews will not replace us. And you're like, whoa, 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 this isn't about, a conversation on conservative values or conservative talking points. This is something totally that I think we all thought had gone away, that if you have people with these views, they hide under rocks, they operate in the deep web, and it is not acceptable to talk that way, to act that way anymore. And to have it just full out in view was really, really shocking. So it certainly caused a number of us to kind of look deeper. You started to talk to law enforcement and find they have, in fact, been seeing more hate crimes, more vandalisms, more suspicious incidents targeted at people predominantly an anti-Semitic, but also people of color. And you, when you were talking to the people that were actually doing the work in the streets, you started to realize like something's been unleashed here. And so at the time, I think we were looking at this, not thinking like this is at the same level as ISIS, but we need to pay attention. We need to do something here. We need to understand what's going on. And then we moved into 2018.
So you start off as Deputy Chief of Staff to John Kelly, who's the Secretary of Homeland Security. And then he moves on to become Trump's Chief of Staff. And so by March, you were in a new role. That's when you became March 2018. You become the Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention. So
yes.
So your job now is you're in charge of these emerging threats. And so this is when you're focusing on these right wing extremists.
Right. And it was one of those kind of jarring moments that you would turn to our intelligence community and say, okay, give me the threat assessment. What do we know about these groups? What's going on? And they couldn't explain it, in large part because our intelligence apparatus isn't designed to do that kind of assessment domestically. We have laws on the books that allow us to look overseas at threats, but we can't use some of those tools domestically for good reason, for constitutional reasons. But it was concerning that nobody inside the government could actually tell you what's their motivation, what is their purpose,
and who are they?
Yeah,
who are these people? And I mean, are they organized? Is it something that are they just being radicalized online? You know, a la ISIS? Are they? How do you describe who these people are? Because I agree with your take that when I first saw these guys, I thought, who are they? This is something that I thought had been erased decades ago. I didn't recognize any of these people, but obviously they were there. They were getting energy, and they were in larger numbers than I would have ever imagined.
Exactly. And it's rather stunning. It prompted me to kind of do my own research, relied on think tanks that have looked at this. Nonprofits like the ADL have been tracking incidents for across the decades. But one person in particular that really helped me put this into context was a professor out of the University of Chicago named Kathleen Ballou. And she wrote a book called Bring the War Home and describes the nature of the white power movement from the 70s until just after Oklahoma City. So she's a historian, and she's looking through historical records to kind of paint this picture. But I found it really helpful to understand that what we're seeing today, it's not as if it just popped up. This is decades long planning and intentional strategic approach to this movement. So a couple of things that...
By whom?
By the white power movement. And she calls them a movement as opposed to an organization intentionally, because part of their strategy is to form leaderless resistance. They found that if they were organized, if they had somebody at the top that was, you know, a name, that it was easier for law enforcement to go after them and take them down. So in 1983, she points that they got together, the neo-Nazis, the Klan, a group of, you know, different organizations, militia organizations. They came together and changed their strategy, and for the first time articulated that their goal was the overthrow of the government, and that the way that they were going to do it was through this leaderless resistance approach. And the piece about the overthrow of the government is I find really fascinating, because you have to go even further back to understand why that's a significant shift for them. The fact is that the concept of white supremacy has been within our governments, within the U.S. government since our founding, right? And most Americans understand and appreciate that. But we kind of lose some historical granularity when it comes to the post-Civil War Reconstruction era. There are pictures from in the 1920s of people in Klan's get up walking down Pennsylvania Avenue, walking down the Washington Mall.
I've seen that picture. Yeah, huge crowds.
Yeah.
Well, look, the Klan was a major factor at Democratic conventions in 1920, exactly. 1924.
So for a century, government was in support of white supremacy, right? Like they were aligned in their goals. And then the Civil Rights Act gets passed, the Vietnam War occurs, and you have a whole bunch of people come home very angry at the government. And there's this realization, the government is no longer supporting our aims. And the only way for us to deal with this is to overthrow them.
So Can you give me a profile of a young male person who is in this? They're mainly males, right? I mean, I know that there are women who are part of this, but I'm focusing again on the images from Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. I guess part of me, you know, you're talking about as a movement. I'm just seeing disaffected guys who've been playing too many video games in their mom's basement, who can't get girlfriends, who've been reading batshit crazy stuff. I mean, give me a profile of the kind of person that is attracted to doing this, the kind of person that would show up at Charlottesville, the kind of person that would show up, you know, at a, you know, in a city like Kenosha or Portland with a knife, a gun, or, you know, a vehicle to ram somebody. Who are these people?
You know, there it's hard to give you a single profile, yeah. Right? So there are, and Dr. Ballou kind of describes this in her book, and again, she's talking historically, but has asserted that these descriptions probably apply today. There's not a lot of good data about what's happening today. So she always applies that caveat. But the, you know, at the core, you're going to have a small group of adherents who organize their lives around this ideology that we, the great replacement theory is happening, and therefore I need to marry people of like mind, produce white babies, and it's almost like a church, right? You do life together. You go to picnics together, and you form your life around this ideology. And then outside of that core is going to be another. A larger group that maybe believe but don't necessarily organize their lives around it, but they would attend rallies. They don't mind being associated with it, but they're not maybe as hardcore as the true adherents. And then you have an additional concentric circle of people who understand that it would not be appropriate or socially acceptable for them to be public about their beliefs, but hold them in fact and will support through, you know, other means, maybe financially or maybe just in consumption of material and trying to spread the rhetoric and recruit people. So part of the way that the white power movement has been successful is that they have capitalized on whatever the grievances are of in the moment. So things that tend to be fairly political, fairly conservative causes, they often use for recruitment purposes. And one of the things that I think is so important and why I've been very frustrated that we haven't had a clear voice from the top of our government call out this threat is that they are using things like a fear of immigration, a fear of refugees coming to our country, a fear of the government taking away your guns. They're
This sounds familiar.
Exactly. They're using things that on its face, it is perfectly reasonable for a conservative to have a conversation about gun rights or about you know, the proper way that we bring refugees in and make sure they're screened and vetted. But the moment that you go into that fear place and this grievance gets set in, it allows individuals to become vulnerable to being recruited into deeper, darker things. So that's the concern I have, is that you have probably any number of people that are unwitting to the fact that they are being preyed upon. And then your core question about, like, how do you what's the profile of somebody that goes and carries out an attack? That there's been a lot of research on. And those individuals do tend to be, you know, disaffected. They lack belonging in some way. They've often had stressors in their life. They have risk factors. And the Secret Service's National Threat Assessment Center, the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, has studied attackers over the last three decades and put together kind of a picture of what these factors might be, which is really helpful for the line of business I was in. It allowed us to design prevention programming to be able to identify these individuals, hopefully before they cross a criminal threshold, get them help, get them, address those core root causes before they carry out an act of violence.
Okay, so let's talk about one of these attacks. And I know you've talked about this extensively. This attack, the El Paso shooting from August of 2019, where you had this 21-year-old gunman who kills 23 people, wounds 26 others in the parking lot of a Walmart. And let me read you something that you had said. You said, when you see the El Paso attacker, his manifesto was citing language and rhetoric that comes from the president's campaign rallies about an invasion from Mexico and how we've got to protect our country. So there's one of those moments where we have to confront these words and these themes have consequences. And whatever the intention is, this is actually feeding the phenomenon that you're talking about.
Exactly. And I can appreciate that maybe he did not understand that his words were having this effect.
You're talking about Trump.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Post El Paso, there is no excuse. It just, the correlation was so clear that this individual carried out this attack because of this language that to be fair, certainly the white power movement has been advocating, certainly even, conservatives that would not consider themselves white supremacists have expressed this concern. But when it comes from the top, when it comes from the president, it carries a lot more weight and it spreads through in a way that just normal chatter online doesn't have the power to spread. So the moment that you realize that your rhetoric is aligned with this attacker's justification for killing people, the proper response is to come out and condemn it, to come out and say, look, folks, there's a difference between what I'm trying to do and protect our country and build a wall and you taking matters into your own hands. There's a way that he could have done it and still, I'm sure he would have been criticized, but there's a way he could have done it and still been able to stay true to his policy goals of building a wall.
But of course, that's not his style. His style, which you've also described, is to use rhetoric that intends to sow fear, right? I mean, the point of his rhetoric is actually to gin people up and to scare people.
Exactly. And we see it on full display this summer. It is part of my own process of coming to grips with the fact that I could not vote for him, and not just decide to do a write-in candidate, but to vote for Joe Biden is realizing how dangerous his rhetoric is and his unwillingness to change. It is so clear to me that his values, what he cares about is himself. He cares about his political power. He cares about winning. And at the sacrifice of people dying. And I cannot.
So this was one of the key moments for you, right? I mean, the El Paso shooting, because I've been doing a little bit of background reading, and you were really trying to secure funding specifically to address domestic extremism. But this administration really doesn't. I mean, do they want to call it domestic extremism? I mean, were they willing to acknowledge the fact that there is right-wing terrorism, that there is right-wing violence out there? Or is that kind of taboo in this administration?
It is taboo in this administration. Secretary Nielsen asked to address this as early as December 2017. She was rebuffed by the National Security Council. She asked again later that summer. She was rebuffed again. We asked again after the attack in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue in October 2018. Again, we're pushed off. And over and over and over again, it was clear that the National Security Council was not going to take this on. And in the moment, we just assumed, and this may still be the case, but we assumed that the reason they weren't taking it up is that they wanted to focus on other international threats, Iran and ISIS. And there's some, I'll give them some deference. There's a lot of threats that we face globally, and if they have the right to set that prioritization. But the point at which my position changed and said, no, at this point you're culpable, is after El Paso. And there was clearly a sense in the White House that politically they were vulnerable because they jumped into action in a way that I haven't seen them act and any of the other attacks that have occurred. Now, in other attacks, the president would come out and condemn it. He is on the record as calling out against anti-Semitic attacks. So it's not that he had not spoken out against these attacks. It's just that for the first time, you started to see them doing the policy work around what is happening with all of this violence. But that's how they saw it. They very much framed it as these are mentally unwell people, and we need to address the root cause of their mental wellness. So you saw them investing in, we need to increase funding for mental health. We need to work on gun control, which, hey, I think we should have a robust conversation about that. But I thought it was kind of ironic that they thought that in the current state of politics that they were actually going to be able to touch the third rail of DC politics. And then when we brought to them the prevention strategy that we had been working on for about 18 months, they were extremely supportive. They were like, this is great. We totally support. We'll make sure that we get this built into the budget that comes out in February. But we're just going to call it violence prevention.
Violence prevention rather than domestic terrorism.
Exactly. And I said, that's fine. I just need you to know that my secretary, which at the time was McElhinen, and myself will be talking about this in the full context, which is, yes, we do have a problem with targeted violence in this country. The Las Vegas massacre is classified that way. But we also have a significant threat from these domestic terrorists. And statistically speaking, they have killed more people and launched more attacks than any other terrorist threat that we have faced. And they were like, got it. We have to talk about it in terms of violence prevention. And you just, in this administration, when you get told that, you just kind of nod your head and you're like, sure. You got to do your thing. I got to do mine.
So the president is now, though, he is now talking about domestic extremism, but he's really talking about it in terms of what's going on in the streets. He's using it in relationship to Antifa. So let's just sort of fast forward to what we're having right now. This is a president who's running for re-election all in on law and order, potentially saying, look, I am the only thing that stands against you and the domestic extremists who he always characterizes as being on the left. So give me you've watched this, you know what the actual threat is. And yet if you listen to the President of the United States or much of the debate that we're having now, the biggest threat is Antifa. Is Antifa the biggest threat?
Absolutely not. It is widely documented, both in public measures as well as the briefings that I would receive when I was in the government, that they are what we would consider a low grade threat, the kind of thing that a local police department or a state police department would need to be aware of if it's operating in their jurisdiction. Usually they become a problem in a counter protest type of scenario. So like what we saw in Charlottesville, you have one group that's there to support something that most of us would in America would condemn, like white supremacy. And then they show up to counter that protest. And at times that turns violent. But their motive and their intention is not necessarily violence against people. So statistically speaking, they are not the ones that commit these acts that kill.
Okay. So talk to me about the Boogaloo movement or its association with QAnon. Where does that all fit into this?
You know, it's funny because every day you wake up and there's like a new group that's been named. But this
Boogaloos.
Exactly. This is part of that leaderless resistance concept, right? So when you are leaderless, you can create something new and everybody will kind of support you. But the aim there is still the same. They're trying to disrupt our way of life. They're trying to eventually overthrow the government. So Boogaloo is maybe not as extreme in certain ideologies, but they all kind of tend to tie together. And clearly they've been arrested in several of the protests that have occurred this summer, including under investigation, a possible indictment for or are being indicted for the killing of a DHS employee, a federal protective service officer. So, you know, the threat that these folks pose is that they tend to see these protests, these peaceful protests, or even the protests that aren't peaceful that have moved into rioting and looting, they view this as an opportunity to come in and accelerate the deconstruction of our society. Because again, the ultimate goal is we want to disrupt the world as we know it so that we can assert a white nation, so we can become, go back to our glory days and be a white nation. So they view any opportunity to disrupt our social order as a benefit to their cause. Rita Katz did a really great explanation of this yesterday. And I would encourage your listeners to go read it, because she does much more justice than I do trying to help explain the value of chaos to an extremist. And it's very telling. The QAnon's a little different. QAnon is, it almost feels like it started as a parlor game of, you know, people that got bored and were just kind of fantasizing about, you know, different crazy things. But then every once in a while you find that people actually believe it. They actually believe that there are people drinking children's blood and worshiping Satan and running huge child sex trafficking rings. And can I just say, for anybody that might be on the edge that maybe some of this is true, I have held that clearance. I worked human trafficking. I have looked at emerging threats across our country. Nothing that they pose is true. So it is, if it's a threat, it's a threat in two ways. One, it distracts from important work that does go on in human trafficking. With one of the things that QAnon was really stirring up over the, I think it was in August, about Wayfair, about how Wayfair was trafficking children by selling cabinets. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that, you know, many well-meaning Americans were alarmed that something like that could happen. So they called the human trafficking hotline, Polaris. And Polaris came out after the fact and said, look, we know statistically how many real human trafficking victims call us on any given day. And we know that some of those calls didn't get through because our lines were flooded with this false narrative. So I would beg the reasonable person that listens to this podcast, please, please do your homework before you cause harm to a real human trafficking victim. These theories that you see on the internet, they aren't true. And there's so much damage that goes unseen because they keep propagating it.
On last week's podcast, I talked with Miles Taylor, who, of course, was one of your colleagues at the Department of Homeland Security. And I'm going to ask you this similar question to one that I asked him. You were there from the beginning, 2017, through the end of 2019. What took you so long to realize you didn't want to be part of this? Why did you stay so long? Because I'm guessing that early on, you looked around and go, that a lot of this stuff I can't support.
Yeah, you know, it actually started before the election, before the inauguration. I said no twice to coming in, and it was the third time that somebody asked me that, and they were describing what they were seeing during the transition period, the backstabbing, the folks that were coming in were only about themselves. They didn't have any experience in the Homeland Security space. I was really concerned for our country. And at the time, I watched John Kelly's confirmation hearing, and I felt at least reassured that he was a man of experience and integrity. And if I could work for him, then it would be worth the effort to endure the chaos that is Trump world. But it was a hard decision to come in. And I had many moments where I was on my knees praying and asking if it was time to go, because it was exhausting. It was chaotic. It was toxic. You couldn't trust anybody. But the reason that we stayed in, those of us that were of like mind, and there were quite a number of us, the reason we stayed in is because we love our country. And we felt that by staying there, offered top cover to the career civil servants who were trying to do their jobs. We protected them as much as we could from the chaos above us. And we felt that, especially at the beginning, there was a time period where the president was steerable. You can move him in the right direction to, you know, not necessarily say there's only one right answer, but, you know, look at these three options as opposed to this extreme measure. And there was a period where that we were able to do that. But at this point, as they like to say, all of the adults in the room have left. And by the end of 2019, it was becoming really clear to me that I needed to move on. I knew at that point I wasn't going to vote for him. If somebody had asked me earlier, I probably could have told you in 2018 or 2017 that I wouldn't vote for him again. But I just hadn't thought about it. And once I started going through that process, I came to the realization I needed to move on. But the other piece that that I like to point out, and I hope it doesn't come off as defensive, but my line of work is counterterrorism. So I've learned a lot about immigration in the last few years, but I did not come in working on that issue set, and right. So it took me a while to understand how much I disagreed with their immigration policies, and that said, it wasn't the thing I was responsible for, and there were important things in that counterterrorism bucket that I could contribute to, and that's why I stayed as long as I did.
So are you in touch at all with John Kelly anymore?
No, I'm not. I think the world of him, and I'm in touch with people that are in touch with him.
So let's look ahead, because you mentioned a little while ago that many of these movements thrive in an environment of chaos, but we have a president whose style is defined by chaos.
Exactly. I mean,
he was the chaos candidate, and now he's the chaos president. So right now, I mean, I have the sense, and I don't think you're going to talk me off this ledge. I just have a sense you're not going to talk me off this ledge, that this country is a powder keg, that when you have the president of the United States who sees his role as being, you know, the chaos maker in chief as opposed to the healer in chief, this thing seems like it's spiraling almost on a daily basis with more encouragement for extremism and an escalation to violence. The way in which Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old shooter in Kenosha, is being made a folk hero on the right strikes me as just one of the most dangerous and reckless things that I've seen happen in American politics in a very long time. And it seems to fit exactly into the scenarios that you've been describing.
I'm not going to talk you off that ledge. I share your concern. I don't know. And that's part of the reason I'm speaking out. I feel like there are, to borrow the phrase, there is a large silent majority that is watching in horror and is afraid to speak out. And I've heard from many of those folks since I've started talking about how they've been having the same concerns, but they're afraid to speak out because they might get attacked by Republicans and they might get attacked by Democrats. And it's so hard to know how to speak in a way that just even raises your concerns and not get attacked. And it's so sad that that's where we are in our country, that you cannot ask a question without fear of being attacked by both sides. But I do hope that by having these dialogues, by drawing attention to the fact that there are evil groups, and on the extreme, this is not the preponderance of Republicans or conservatives, but they are there on the extreme and they are exploiting this. And therefore you conservative, you Republican, you moderate, you liberal, be careful with your rhetoric. Think about what you're going to say before you say it. Stop using the talking points and actually think through the issue that you're trying to discuss or resolve. If we would listen to each other more instead of just yelling at each other, and I realize that the example that we have in the Oval Office right now is the exact opposite, but we can do better than this. But I share your concern, and I talk with many other law enforcement and counterterrorism professionals, and we are all very, very concerned that we will see an increase in violence. Some of it will may look like the type of violence we've seen in the last couple of weeks, which are not necessarily premeditated, but just that powder keg effect of angry people that have weapons with them and not good judgment, and then they act out in violence. So I am concerned about that. I'm also concerned that we have people in that extreme fringe who would love to carry out a mass attack, who would love to repeat an Oklahoma City bombing. In fact, there was an arrest of somebody who was attempting to outdo McVeigh in Oklahoma City this summer. So we have two threats. We have the powder keg, throw fuel on the fire, angry, polarized rhetoric that is increasing, not premeditated violence, but nonetheless, it's kind of, you know, one of those things that if you're clear-headed, you kind of can see you probably shouldn't put two angry people together with weapons. You know, maybe that's not a good idea.
You think? Yeah, I mean, I'm a supporter of the Second Amendment, as I'm sure you are. But you know, your point is, look, as this thing escalates, and you do have people with powerful weapons in close proximity, with rhetoric demonizing one another, calling one another enemies, where the rhetoric encourages you to think of your opponent, I mean, the person standing across from you, you know, as an enemy of the people, an enemy of democracy, whatever, bad things are going to happen inevitably. And when you make heroes out of the people who shoot and kill other people, there's an escalation. Yeah. So we've had a process of the radicalization of some of these extremists. I feel in some ways we're watching the radicalization of an entire movement. And by a movement, I mean lots of folks on the right who I never would have imagined coming up with rationalizations for acts of violence, even the killing of people in the streets. And once you cross that, you just don't know where it's going to go. You don't know. There are too many people out there who are unstable, too many situations that are completely unpredictable, and that's where we're at. And we have 60 days to go, and it's not going to get calmer between now and November.
Absolutely. I'll add to it the, I cited earlier the Secret Service's research, the FBI's research. One of the commonalities in an attacker is that they've usually had a series of stressors in their life. So they've lost a job, or they've lost a loved one, or they've had a bad breakup, or something significant in their life changed, right? So it's not as if any of us in 2020 have experienced stressors, right? I mean, the nature of a pandemic alone, fear associated with something so unknown and unseen.
Great point.
Am I going to get sick and losing jobs, or having the kids at home and trying to juggle the job? All of these stressors are universal for our society right now. So you take somebody that already was maybe disaffected, didn't feel a sense of belonging, socially isolated. Now they're even more socially isolated because nobody's allowed to leave their homes. No. And then you have these additional stress of maybe the economy or death or what they're seeing on TV and the president's rhetoric. All of that is just a really, really scary mix of the type of thing that leads somebody to carry out an attack.
And there we are on September 4th, 2020. Elizabeth Newman, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and being so generous with your time.
Well, thank you, Charlie. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate what you all do.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We have a long weekend. We will be back on Tuesday, and we will do this all over again. There are now 59 days to go until the November election.